了。
Thank you, John. Can anyone see me? My name is Tom. I am an alcoholic. I belong to the Green Acres group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Lethbridge, Alberta, the Adam group of Al-Anon. I may not be the best speaker in the world, but I think you'll find I'm the most grateful alcoholic in the world. And it's really a pleasure and an honor to be asked to come and speak with you here tonight. I have a friend who takes his watch off, Stan from Saskatoon. He says to the audience, says, "I don't mind if you look at your watches while I'm speaking, but if you hold them up to your ear and shake them, I get a little concerned." It's always a pleasure to come down to the States and spend some of my 65 cent dollars. I think it's always a spiritual opening to the weekend. I always forget how beautiful the scenery is coming down here. And it was a lovely drive. I did see one old drunk sitting down the street here, and I said, "Isn't this beautiful?" And he said, "Take away the scenery and what do you have?" I enjoyed the meetings. I really did enjoy Judy today. Enjoyed the old timers. To meet Earl again. Earl has joined the ranks of the adults like myself. That's when you stop growing at the ends and start growing in the middle. Otherwise known as furniture disease. When your chest starts sliding into your drawers. I'm also not getting younger. 10 weeks ago I joined the ranks of the old cardiacs around here. I had heart surgery 10 weeks ago, and I was sharing it with all my friends with the furniture disease around the corner last night. I'm very happy to be here, happy to be anywhere. My checkup was 100%, and I aim to live to be an old timer. Saw an old lady sitting drinking in the bar. She was putting 2 drops of water into every martini. Fascinated me. I walked over and said, "Why do you drink like this?" She says, "Sonny, when you get to my age, you can hold your liquor, but you sure can't hold your water." John called me, it seems a long, long time ago, and asked me to come here to speak to the 4-H Club. I was confused for a minute. Heaves, hives, hallucinations and hemorrhoids. I think you're all here. Yep. John likes a joke. He took us into the dining room last night, and we had a lovely meal. Told Teresa and I to charge it to his room. Thank you very much, John. That was lovely. It made me feel like the duck who walked into the pharmacy. Said to the pharmacist, "Give me a chapstick." The pharmacist said, "Will this be cash or charge?" He said, "No, just put it on my bill." Just for you, John. The same duck came back a week later and asked for a condom. The pharmacist said, "Will I put this on your bill too?" He said, "What kind of duck do you think I am?" I've got so many friends and family here, I don't know what I can tell any of you people tonight, because most of you taught me everything I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just beautiful to see you there, family and friends, new friends. And you have a lovely theme, recovery through love. And you will hear through the course of this weekend that there is no recovery if you're incapable of love, as I was when I came to AA. And I hope tonight to touch on some of the help that was given to me and some of the guidance that helped me to develop into a more loving individual and into a more recovering individual. As you've gathered by now, there are 2 official languages in Canada. English and French, and I don't speak either one of them. So if you want me to repeat anything, just hold up your hand. Actually, I'm half Irish and half Scots. A terrible dilemma. Half of me has wanted to get drunk all my life, and the other half wouldn't pay for it. I understand there are a lot of Irishmen in Butte. I may come back to you later. I was born in a little village, a mining town like this in Scotland. My father was a coal miner. There were four of us in the family. We were living at the pinnacle of poverty on $50 a week. My grandfather lived with us. He was 92. He wasn't an alcoholic. My mother wasn't an alcoholic. My father wasn't an alcoholic. Now my older brother is in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous very recently. I started to put him in treatment before I started drinking. My younger brother is an alcoholic in the Fellowship. And when I went back to my father's funeral, I found out all my uncles were alcoholics. And this is a family condition. It's medically accepted biogenetic illness. And I could really depress all of you if we didn't have this beautiful program to enable us to create a climate where our children and children's children will make, hopefully, the recovery that we have to this point in time. This was a strange little town in Scotland. It was half Irish and half Scots, like I was. They all fought with each other, Catholics and Protestants. There was a civil war going on all the time. And nearly everyone in the town was drunk. I used to say to my brother, there's only one difference between a funeral and a wedding in this town. One less guy drunk. And I didn't think much of things religious when I was growing up there. I was coming home as a teenager in my motorcycle. A big group of Irish Catholic laborers knocked me off the bike, said, "Let's kick the you-know-what out of this little Protestant." And before I could make the sign of the cross, they did it. The teachers in school were telling me that to be acceptable by God, or at least I had it this way, I had to try to be perfect or become perfect, and I just couldn't measure up, as I've heard this morning here. If you'd asked me at that time in my life what my assets and liabilities were, I would have told you that my liabilities were my poverty and my height. The kids in school used to say things like, "Tom Melling is so small, he's just a waste of good skin." But I don't think that's funny. And we used to make jokes about how poor we were. My younger brother told me, "I saw Dad stripping the wallpaper off the walls last night." He said, "Good, Dad, we're redecorating this place at last." And he said, "No, son, we're moving today." That's bad. In any case, I would have felt that my greatest asset was my intelligence, because the teachers in school kept telling me what a bright little boy I was, patting me on the head and not helping my growth problem. And they accelerated me through school, and I finished grade 12 at the age of 15. And then I went on to university and I did a science degree until I was old enough to go into medical school. And I went on to take many degrees. And Father Martin tells you thermometers have degrees too, and you know where to stick those. In this little Irish town of ours, and with its feuding and fighting, I remember very well a story I heard about an Irish farmer. He was in his field and a little leprechaun jumped out and he said, "Begorra, I didn't know you little fellas really existed." And the little fellow said, "Yes, and I can grant you any wish that you want in the whole world. You can have anything, money, just name it. The only condition is that your neighbor over there, old Farmer Murphy, he gets twice as much as you do." He said, "But don't let that deter you. You can have millions." So he scratched his head for a minute. He said, "Murphy, is it very painful to have one testicle removed?" As I went on to medical school, I finished a medical degree. Some people are born alcoholics, and I became alcoholic by degrees. And I went shortly after I qualified as a doctor. I was drafted to the army in Cyprus, and I saw lots of young people killed during the conflict in Cyprus. We did surgery one day, like a MASH team, and we were drinking the next day. It was my introduction to alcoholism. We'd operate the next day and drink the next day. It was just horrible. I had married the daughter of the school principal, beautiful girl, and I had to make her life an utter hell before it was finished. Our first son was born in Cyprus, and after 2 years there, I brought her back to Scotland, a very disillusioned young woman with her baby and a bright spark of a husband who was talking about training and surgery and busy getting drunk all the time. A few years after I finished the surgical training in Scotland and my drinking was progressing, I decided to take a geographic cure. I opened a magazine one day and there was an advertisement for a surgeon in Lethbridge in Canada. And I'm a very romantic person, and it described the Rocky Mountains and this lovely town. And I thought about the things I'd seen in the movies, the Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald and those lovely Royal Canadian Mounted Police I got to know very well. So I packed my bags and family, and we all moved over to inflict ourselves on Lethbridge and for me to drink Canada dry. I made a very poor start as a surgeon in Lethbridge, and I must recall, for the benefit of the newcomers, that I did a lot of useful things in my life and good things while I was drinking. And I don't want to forget to tell you that, because it's really important to know when you come into this fellowship, if you have the self-esteem that I had, that you have done many, many good things in your life, and you have to think about them and draw on the strength of them. And I know that I did achieve many creditable things in that period of my life. However, I want to share some of the useless things I did while I was in Lethbridge, just to identify with the program. As I say, it wasn't very long before I was in Canada that I saw these lights flashing behind my car, and this gave Nelson Eddy's song a new meaning. "When I'm calling you." I once went downtown and walked into one of the crummier hotels in Lethbridge, seeking lower companionship. Tripped in the toilet, fell over the toilet bowl, and got wedged in my shoulders upside down behind the toilet. And I stayed there for a long time. And the more you wriggle in a ridiculous situation like that, the more impacted you become in it. And I was looking around with strange thoughts like, I wish they had a better janitorial service. And what's a man in your position doing in this position? But somebody finally came and pulled me out. I told this story in Harvard. I was about to speak in Harvard, and a young fellow came up and he said, "Don't forget to tell them about the time you fell in the toilet." And I was talking away, I was talking on like this, and I saw him out there, and I said, "Boy, I'd forgotten about falling in the toilet until I saw your face." I hope I do hope you'll go back and apologize to him if he's still around. At that time in my life, I thought I'd maybe discipline myself from the outside and leave no time in my life to drink. So I joined everything, school boards, medical associations. I was on about 13 committees a week, and I still managed to get drunk. And I said to myself, Tom, this is not working out. Why don't you do some occupational therapy at night? So I decided to build a television, an alcoholic television, not black and white, not small, 26-inch color television. And I managed to do this over 3 months. And I switched it on, and it worked. The Galloping Gourmet was on, I'll never forget it. He had a bottle of wine in his hand. He was cooking there. I said, time to celebrate. So I went downtown for a drink, and I came back home miraculously drunk. My wife had left me. I tripped in the carpet. The poor television wasn't even in a cabinet yet. I put my head right through it. The thing exploded in my face. It's a spiritual awakening if you've never had one. And I was left with this great gaping wound from my eye below my ear. Another cut in my chin. I was spouting. I put towels on my head and drove through the streets like Yasser Arafat. And I wasn't going to go near any of my local doctors, so I went to my own office to stitch this up. Left a trail of blood there, got to the mirror without any anesthetic. I stitched it and missed a bit. I caught that in the morning. Couldn't see behind my ear. Stitched up my chin. My secretary came in apparently the next morning and saw all this blood. And I don't know who she was writing to, but she resigned. She moved to Vancouver, and I've never seen her since. My wife left me, as I say, went to England. I went over there, and I stopped drinking for 6 weeks, and I brought the family back again. I'm doing pretty well for a little while. My wife said to me, Tom, you're doing so well now. She never knew anything or wanted to know anything about Al-Anon, I'm sorry to say. Doing so well, maybe you could handle some wine with your meals. And I lit up like a Christmas tree. And she couldn't cook fast enough. And I was drinking wine in bed and wine for breakfast, wine during the day, wine at night. And that's how it finished. I don't know about you, I was very unlucky when I drank. I seemed to have many accidents. Could never understand why. I broke my arm 3 times. I broke my ribs. Compound fractured my leg. I didn't know I'd broken my spine until a few years ago. I had an x-ray. The doctor said, when did you fracture your spine? And I really didn't know. I was in so many accidents. I told him it must have been during one of my mountaineering trips. In any case, shortly before I came to you, I drove into a car one night, no one in it fortunately, bounced off this car, engaged in this chase with the mounted police, and I managed to lose them in a research station somewhere and my lights out, and I thought I was very clever until they arrested me in the morning. They had my license plate number hours before, and they took me before a judge. The judge told me I was on so many committees, he didn't want to take me into the courthouse. He fined me. He told me to straighten up. I walked out into the street, and with all this intelligence that I have, I said to myself, you've got this whole town in your pocket now. So back to the bar. And many years later, I walked into an AA meeting in North Lethbridge. The barman was at the meeting. The policeman who arrested me was at the meeting, and in walked a judge. I was in the hospital about 6 weeks before I came here. A very dear friend of mine, a senior surgeon there, he collapsed, and he had a complicated bowel obstruction. And he asked me to operate on him, and I was feeling very ill. And I said no. His wife called me. And between them, I'd gone home, I had to escape, and they kept appealing to me until I decided I would come in and do this operation, having drunk about a bottle of vodka by that time, which has saved more than one life. I'm pleased to tell you he's still alive, but I did 3.5 hours of surgery on him that morning, and I left the hospital with very little memory of what I had done, and with a terror inside of me. And then with my intelligence, I said, "Tom, you've got to quit surgery and take up drinking full time." And I did. And that was the last time that I ever operated in that fashion, thank God. As I say, John and I are very friendly today. His wife is dying of cancer while we're down here. And he's been a great support to me. I've made light of a lot of this, and you know too well the pain and suffering in my family. I told you I'd severed connections with any God a long time ago in my life. Communications had broken down with my family, with my wife, were non-existent, with my children. They were twitching when they saw me and disappearing into the basement. They didn't know what kind of father to really expect to see. And finally I thought I was losing connection with my own mind. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we reverse all of that, most likely in the opposite direction, and hopefully reconnect with our families and finally with a higher power. But I had really decided when I left that hospital that I was going to kill myself. And I went out into British Columbia to drink myself to death. I had another bad accident and I broke my arm. And finally I came in after several weeks into Lethbridge, very sick, very tired, another cast on my arm. And when I was at my very lowest, I made that most important phone call of my life. I called a young journalist I'd met a few years before, and we were sitting talking, and I said, "You don't drink anymore," and I knew he had been a terror of a drinker. And he said, "No, Tom, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous and I've been sober for a year." And with all my intelligence I said, "Jim, I'm really sorry to hear that." But that night it was Jim who came into my thoughts, and I called him and he said, "Have you been drinking?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "How long?" And I said, "They tell me for weeks." And listen to this, he said, "I'll be straight over to see you." And I know tonight that if Jim hadn't come over that night, I would not be alive today. Jim didn't live very long. As Judy talked about today, losing a sponsor is a painful experience. He died at 31 of a brain operation. And on his deathbed, he said, "Go back to those AA turkeys, Tom, and tell them to be gentle with themselves." And he was a super guy. He took me to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the unforgettable one. I walked into that room, and I looked around, and there were all these crazy signs, and one of them said, "Isn't it swell to be here?" And I thought that I was destined for bread and water for the rest of my life. And an old fellow that you heard mentioned today by Tiny, came over, old Mel friend, and he said he was glad to see me. And I doubted that, put his arm around me, and I didn't like that very much. And he told me he loved me, and I wanted to run out the door. But Mel said some interesting things to me. He put together three words: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I'd never had those words stuck together before. He told me if I kept hanging around the cooks in that chapter house, that one day my life would come back together, and one day I would get the respect of the doctors in my own town. And I thought the man was totally insane. And I sat down, and all I remember of that meeting was the white eyeballs that this man had who was sitting across the table from me, because I was a pitiful sight. And I wanted his eyeballs. And I was willing to go to any length to get those. And that's it. They gave me a big book, and I went home that night, and I opened the big book, and the first thing it says is the doctor's opinion. Now, who needs the doctor's opinion? I skipped that. Then Bill's story, I didn't know Bill. I moved on to there is a solution. And they say they did that on purpose. I knew the answer. I had to quit drinking. But a solution takes lots of work. And there was lots of work to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got really involved with fellows like Myron and Tiny, and going down to meetings and hearing these old timers, as they call themselves, starting up crazy projects, halfway houses and things like that. And one night, about three in the morning, the telephone rang. I picked it up. There was a DJ on from the radio station, and he said, "Are you the alcoholic doctor?" And I said, "I've been called worse at 3 a.m. So he said, "We have a young man over there in North Lethbridge who has a shotgun and he's going to kill himself over alcoholism. Would you go and speak to him?" So I said, "Sure," drove to the north side, saw a light in this house, in the kitchen. So I opened the back door and I went into the kitchen, and there was the loudest explosion I ever want to be close to again. And he blew the kitchen cabinet away with his 12-gauge just above my head. Great big hole. And it was then that I realized what an asset it is to be 5'4" tall. Before he died, Jim told me something about the powerlessness in the first step of AA. And today I operate from a position and a posture of personal powerlessness. We've heard about that this weekend. I have no power over other people, over my family. I have no power over the outcome of my surgery. I don't do the healing. And I had no problem with the insanity of the second step. And we've heard that our dilemma is power. And I wasn't long in Alcoholics Anonymous until I realized I was plugged into a real potent source of power. But I could not for years relate that to any spiritual connotation, or could I understand a concept of God. It drove me crazy. I went all over the country, read all the religions. Call it my period of paralysis of analysis. Never got anywhere. Went to see Father Barney, old Barney from Palo Alto. Said to Barney, "What can you do about this third step, making a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God when you don't understand God?" Barney said a very penetrating and observant thing to me. He said, "Go and hang your brain on the line for a year and come back to speak to me." And I did that. And a year later, I came back and I spoke to Barney. In the meantime, the boys in the chapter house had told me to come to meetings every night for a year and a half. They obviously didn't think I was a 90-day case. So I went back to see Barney, and he told me, "You took Latin at school, decidere to cut off, deciduous trees, the leaves fall." He said, "This is a pruning process that you're beginning, Tom." He said, "You have to cut away everything that stands between you and this concept, and you know what those things are." And this made some sense to me. My younger brother is an artist, and he told me that Michelangelo, after he carved the statue of David, was asked how he ever visualize such a beautiful work of art. And he said, I cut away everything that wasn't David. I cut away everything that wasn't David. And this opened the door for me, and I was able to move an inch forward to a concept of the spirituality of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was able to appreciate the beauty of nature, as we've spoken about, to see some of the musician behind a piece of music, to see something of the sculptor behind the sculpture, and the painter behind the painting. And my life started to improve. All Mel's promises did come true. Within a very few years, I was chief of staff of the hospital. I was chief of the department of surgery. I was enjoying my children and animals on a little farm. And my wife and I had never been able to re-communicate. And she went off to do a degree in university, and I started to look after my four children that had arrived by that time, my three sons and a daughter of 8 years old. And I was single parenting, as they like to call it, just making a mess of everything, I call it. And one day she wrote a letter to me, and she said she wasn't coming back. By the time this had happened in my life, I had come as far as taking the insight step four. I had sat down and taken a critical look at Tom to the point that I could look right through myself to all the phoniness, the deceit, the infidelity, the filth of alcoholism. I had been able to go to a young priest, Father Joel from Montana, here in a parking lot, no big deal, and spill my guts and do what we call a fifth step, and that removes the power of the past. I can assure you I didn't feel much closer to God when I finished that fifth step. In fact, he said to me, Tom, said, Tom, I think God is transmitting on FM and you're tuned into EM. He said, but keep listening. But here I was, looking at these steps of six and seven, defects of character, shortcomings. And in the middle of all of this, in my mail, is this letter that just crushed and totally destroyed me. Just fragmented and splintered my family into a million pieces. And it was the most painful period of my whole life. I had unhappy kids crying, shaking, confused. My wife moved off, and I was really angry. I was angry at myself that I couldn't fix the relationship. I was angry at Alcoholics Anonymous for the promises. And I went into a desert, as my friend Mac Cheater from Winnipeg used to call these periods of his life. And it was during this horribly unhappy time that I finally came into contact with a loving God as I understand my God to be today. I found out lots of things about God. I found out that He loved me the way I was and too much to leave me that way. I found out that He wasn't enjoying my misery and He wasn't inflicting the pain. It came to me with a suddenness that should have been obvious, that I, as a surgeon, had operated on people for 20 years and caused lots of pain, and it was never my intention. It was always done to improve the quality or the quantity or length of someone's life. And this pain was the last thing in my mind, and I found out it was the last thing on God's mind as well. Because I wanted to die at that point in time, I didn't feel I had the strength to start a life all over again. I'd had one destruction, I'd crashed out, And now I had these children who'd elected to stay with me, the boys, and I had an 8-year-old daughter that I didn't know if I'd see again. And I held her so tight, that little beautiful blonde doll, that I can feel it now. I wanted to die. But I was given the strength through coming back to you to reconstruct my life. And for that I'll be eternally grateful. I saw a new way of looking at Alcoholics Anonymous. In step one, I found I had a disease. In steps two and three, I picked a surgeon. In step four, we had done investigations. Step five, in that parking lot, I sat down with Joe and God as I understand him today, and I gave informed consent. In steps six and seven, I got the knife. But some things were removed from me in that period of time, and some gifts were given to me that had made it all worthwhile. So for any of you who are suffering that type of pain tonight, I can only tell you that it doesn't come from God, that the strength for me, and I only speak for me, to overcome that situation and reconstruct my life came from finally coming into conscious contact with God as I understand Him, and I've tried to mention it to you today. And the steps of 8 and 9, the amends steps, have something to do with the healing of these wounds. You cannot shorten up the period of healing. I always wanted it to be faster. And I see this when I operate today. I can't take the stitches out on day 2 if they're supposed to come out on day 10. And I had to suffer that for a long time. Amends are not apologies. If you go to work late every morning and say you're sorry, they fire you. There's no question about it. Heard of this guy who was always late for work, was warned. He said, I can't sleep at nights, and then I fall asleep when I should come to work. His boss said, for God's sake, get some sleeping pills. So if one's good, he took 3. He came in 3:45 in the morning and he said to the boss, here I am early today. And the boss says, great, but where were you all day yesterday? I'm not going to say much about doctors tonight. There might be one or two of you out there. But I went to my share of doctors when I was sick. I did go to a psychiatrist once. And I found out later that he was making booze in his basement. And he invited me in and he poured me a big drink and he said, let's talk about your alcoholism now. He did tell me a cute story about the alcoholic who had this recurring nightmare that he was turning into a set of living room drapes. And the psychiatrist said to him, for God's sake, pull yourself together. Have you heard that? He told me to pull myself together anyway. It didn't work. I was in the hospital a few days ago and I said to one of the doctors, what did you operate on that man in 403 for? And he said, $500. I said, you stupid clown, I'm not asking you that. How much, what did he have? And he said, I think he has about $500. So no more about this. In the 10th step of Alcoholics Anonymous, we continue to take inventory. And when we're wrong, we promptly admit it. Now, this touches us into the whole area of learning to love. And I found out that I was incapable of loving until there was some healing in my life. And I found I couldn't heal in hate and disharmony. And only when I learned to forgive myself and other people. But first of all, I had to forgive other people before I could forgive myself. Then I started to heal, and there's been much healing around me and in my family and friends that I'll hopefully share with you tonight. I was unable to receive or give love to people before this time in my life. And there is no freedom without love. And what we are here to talk about tonight is freedom from an addiction. And they talk about freedom from bondage. And freedom just demands that you're capable of loving and capable of forgiving. And this is what we're working on. In step 11, we seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God of our understanding. It does call for some quiet time in your life, calls for some stillness for things to happen. Everything significant that happens in life happens after a period of stillness, whether it's birth or creation, and probably creation and love of every single one of us. We have to take time to be still and to listen, and we have to learn something new about prayer. And it was well discussed this morning in the Let God Be God meeting, and the string that was spoken about this morning that runs between every living thing, this network of life and people around us, God as we understand Him, all one thing, everything we're doing is prayer. If you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to come to this phase of your development, as they call it, then you see some of the promises. And the promises include the miracles, the many, many miracles we see around these rooms and halls of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first miracle was witnessed by Dr. Silkworth. As you know, Silky was a man who had great courage. He stood up before the Medical Society of the AMA and told them, when there was a handful of Alcoholics Anonymous to lend for this table, that we had the answer to this problem. You see, he had honesty, open-mindedness, he had willingness, and he had guts. And you need guts. And you pray for guts in the Serenity Program to stick around. And when he stuck around, he saw that miracle one morning of Bill Wilson. And if you're looking for a God, read Bill's story that I skipped. Read about that and hang on to Bill Wilson's God for a little while. Because I've been around the country, and these sudden spiritual awakenings that people have are by no means rare. And I have one that's very close to me. So, I should tell you about a young fellow I treated about 9 years ago. He was jaundiced, the liver the size of the podium here. He was dying. All the specialists told him he was dying. I told him to speak to the chaplain. I had to leave the city, and when I came back, he was completely, almost healed. And he told me that the night after the chaplain spoke with him, and he resigned himself to die, that there was a light, and he heard a voice, and all it said was he was going to be well. He'd been 8 months in the hospital. And I found out that he was a physician, and he'd never practiced a single day of his life. And he did recover, and he never ever drank again. And about 2 months ago, he was returned into the medical community and is working in Saskatchewan. And it took him a long time to get back. But here is a phenomenal miracle. My mother called me in 73 and she told me my father was dying. And the doctor told me over there, don't come, he's not that bad. And before he hung up the phone, I was on the plane. I heard that voice that we listen to that says, why do you wait? I was by his side that Saturday morning. We spent the whole day together, the best day I ever spent with my father. I told him about you. I told him about my alcoholism. He said, I never met anybody in AA in my life. But go back and tell these people that I love them. And he died. I brought my mother here And a few years ago, and she was the worst case of terminal alanonitis I've ever seen in my life. My sister said, if you fly her to Canada, she'll probably die on you. After 2 weeks with her, I wanted to kill her. She thought that all her lovely boys had been turned into alcoholics by rotten women. And I dragged her to Al-Anon meetings at 86 years old. And you know, one night, she did have a cardiac arrest in my home, and I got her to the hospital, and her heart stopped, and her lungs filled up. And I walked down the corridor of the hospital, and I was thinking of my sister's voice and saying, you'll probably send her back in a casket. I was also thinking about Mac again, that other sponsor I had. Mac had cancer and died of it, and his son had cancer of the leg and died. Mac, before he died, told me on a balcony like this in Great Falls that this is too big a deal for one lifetime. AA is too big a deal. He gave me a dimension of this fellowship and a dimension of love that we're talking about tonight that'll do me for a long, long time. He told me that love is stronger than death, and I believe it. He told me that love, if it's real love, is everlasting, and I believe that. He said, it makes no sense to me, Tom, for God to pick you up out of the mess that we were in and to go through this recovery process and meet these beautiful people and be dumped at the end of it. He said, this is too big a deal. I was thinking of another thing he said in that hospital corridor when my mother was being resuscitated and zapped, as somebody was talking about. And it was when Max said to me, man's extremity is God's opportunity. And it kept ringing through my head till a young doctor ran down and he said, you know, your mother's heart has started to beat. And it did. And she recovered consciousness in a couple of days and she went back to Scotland. We took her back. But that wasn't a miracle. She got the program. My sister called me. She says, what happened to my mother in Canada? I started to talk about the heart. She said, I don't mean that. She said, she keeps phoning us all, telling everybody how much she loves us, and it's driving us all crazy. She had her 10 months of Al-Anon before she finally passed away and spoke to me and to Teresa the night before she died. She said, thank you for everything. You made my day. I always like to have a hit at Al-Anon. My friend Dr. Paul, that you know, always says that there must have been the first alcoholic, and that was Eve. So we call our Al-Anon group the Adam group, because we believe that only an alcoholic would go down the garden to have a conversation with a snake, like Paul said. It makes lots of sense. I was thinking of Adam a few years later walking with Cain and Abel past the Garden of Eden when it was covered in weeds and saying to the kids, this is where your mother drank us out of house and home. That makes more sense than the Bible they taught me. The first reference in the Bible to electronics is when they took a rib from Adam and turned it into a loudspeaker. If you think that's bad, I had an old Al-Anon bring her husband to me, and he was very deaf. She said, very deaf. I checked him over. I said, it's worse than that. He's falling apart in every department. She said, what can I do about it? I said, I think a little more sex would smarten him up a bit. So the old fellow said, what did Dr. Tom say to you? He says, the doctor said you're going to die. My younger brother was an artist in London. He went through drugs and alcohol. He was thrown in a garbage can one night in London. He was picked up and thrown in prison by the police. I flew over to see him in Brixton Prison. I managed to talk him through the authorities and back to Canada. He who was very, very sick. I said, "Do you think alcohol has anything to do with this?" He said, "Yes." "Would you come to an AA meeting?" He said, "Yes." I took him to a meeting, and I watched powerless for an hour. As you worked on him, he came out of the meeting. He jumped up on the sidewalk 3 feet, and he turned around to me and he said, "Tom, that's what I've been looking for all my life." And he stayed in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and today he's become the cartoonist in the biggest newspaper in London. And he'll be coming to Seattle to the World Conference. These are incredible miracles. In 1978, we were looking after these kids and traveling around. I came to a meeting and I stood under Tiny's armpit and gave a talk in Kalispell. And when I was finished talking, this beautiful gal came walking up to me and she said, "I really identified with what you were talking about. We're both going through that period of grief and separation, I suppose." And I said, not knowing, I said, "Well, we're going for ice cream, bring your husband along." And she said, "I don't have a husband." Now, I'm getting smarter by this time. And I said, "I'm very sorry to hear that." And I never let her out of my sight from that day. Teresa and I have become a team. We're married in 82. I call her my American Express. I never leave home without her. Thank you, Teresa. My little blonde escapee is now 19 years old, and she's a bundle of nonsense and is always around me. I have 4 children and Teresa had 3. So we stuck them together, and then we really needed a program. I took them to Disneyland. I thought if I entertained them, they would all start to love each other. That's why I've got no hair today. These kids have been a real joy and lots of pain. We've had to do our share of letting go and all those fun things. But they've all turned out to be beautiful kids, lawyers and music teachers, and I could go on all day. Canadian basketball champion daughter and all that lovely thing, all those lovely things. It's incredible to me what association with Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Al-Ateen has done for our children who were so disastered out in 1977. Myself, everything I ever wanted to do in life and dreamed about, I think I have achieved. As Mel prophesied, I became chief of staff of one hospital, still am. I'm now director of cancer services for Southern Alberta, clinical work in cancer now, and I guess I'm going to spend the rest of my days looking after terminal, hopefully not all terminal, but lots of terminal disease. And I'm only able to do that joyfully through the association with you people. And that has been a great gift to me. I had my American fellowship in surgery. I had my Scottish and I had my Canadian 2 years ago. I came down here and I got my triple crown. I'd always wanted to be a fellow of the College of Surgeons of America. I can't explain to you why I've always had such an admiration for you people. Why I stole your most beautiful gal. But I do appreciate what you've done for me in my life, and I'm very happy that that has come about. When we come to the 11th step of Alcoholics Anonymous and these spiritual awakenings, I have nothing to tell you. Mine was a slow variety, a reluctant spiritual progress, reminds me of a mother calling to her son on a Sunday morning and saying, "Son, would you get up and go to church? Please go to church. Give me two reasons, son, why you won't go to church." And he said, "Nobody likes me down in that church, and I'm totally exhausted today. Give me two reasons why I should go to church." And she said, "Well, you're 55 years old and you're the pastor of that church." I have a pastor in Lethbridge. He said there's so many shotgun weddings coming up in the next couple of months that he's changing the name of the church to Winchester Cathedral. When we come to the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous, we had a spiritual awakening, carry this message, and that's what we're doing for each other this weekend. This is what I'm trying to do for you. I'm always reminded of the words of Mother Teresa of India when she says, "You can't give what you don't live. You can't give what you don't live." She also says that we're not called to be successful in life, we're called to be faithful. Success to me in life now is what we overcome, not what we have. And fidelity is the answer to serenity. To be true to yourself, to your promises, to your program, to your group, to your family, and to your higher power. And this makes life for me pretty beautiful. My father was a coal miner, as I mentioned to you, and when I was very small, I remember he showed me a piece of coal, and he said, "Look at this," and he told us children, "here is a cold, black, tasteless, useless, inert piece of material, and if you put a spark to it, and you light a fire, thousands of years ago, there were trees growing, the sun was shining like today down in these trees, and they fell, and over centuries they became coal. And in that fire, that coal is returning the century-old debt of light and heat, and that is a miracle." And when we come to you, and I come to you tonight, I come to you to tell you, first of all, my father loved you. My father, as I know him today, loves you, every one of you. And I come to you to return my debt of light, some experience, some of the intelligence you have given me, and I have to be transparent as I've tried to be, or that doesn't come through. And I want to return to you my debt of warmth, of love. And God bless you. Thank you.